don't you judge me. You're the selfish one. You're the one who charged his own brother for a Bluth frozen banana. I mean, it's one banana, Michael. What could it cost? $10?
You've never actually set foot in a supermarket, have you?
I don't have time for this.
Welcome to the 24th episode of Egg Timer Philosophy. Before getting started today, I just want to stop and thank the many new listeners the show has seen over the past few weeks for giving the podcast a try, and also to thank those who have been with the show since it started a bit earlier this year. If you want to leave feedback about a show or give a suggestion for a future episode, you can send an email over to eggtimerphilosophy@gmail.com. Or if you know of others who might be interested in these short bursts of philosophy, pass along word of the show to them. Now, on with the show. Today's episode is being released on Black Friday, the date when traditionally many retail businesses in the United States and around the world become profitable given holiday sales. So I thought it might be a good fit today to discuss Thorsten Veblen's idea of conspicuous consumption. Now, Veblen was an American thinker, a bit of an odd mix between a sociologist, an economist, and a philosopher. He was born and raised in the Midwest, and then he goes on to earn a doctorate at Harvard, studying under William Graham Sumner, who himself was a very well-known and influential social Darwinist at the time. After completing his education, Veblen's most important work was his 1899 book, The Theory of the Leisure Class, An Economic Study and the Evolution of Institutions. That book was the most revolutionary and philosophically and socially thought-provoking treatment of economics since Adam Smith's The Wealth of Nations in 1776. In The Theory of the Leisure Class, Veblen, using a good deal of history and anthropology, tries to understand how it is that various societies have often carved out a special designation for some people that allow them to effectively engage in a life of complete leisure with little or no work. The classic example of this might be of a person who lives in a very extravagant life of complete leisure from birth until death, funded entirely by a trust fund that they've inherited. If just about everyone must work and contribute for the better part of their day and enjoy what little leisure they can after this is done, how could society establish institutions that allow some to have almost total, complete, conspicuous leisure? Veblen's answer in here involves a sociological theme of social status. If an individual is deemed to be important enough within a social structure, then they are removed from the general expectation of work before leisure. The exception to this expectation is granted precisely because it solidifies differential social status. If the social rules surrounding work applied to all of us equally, then social status wouldn't mean very much. It might not mean anything at all. And for whatever reasons, and those reasons could get complex, people in all sorts of various cultures generally do tend to support social, political, and economic structures that solidify designations of social status. One of Veblen's great insights is to link up this theory of the leisure class directly with consumption. A member of the leisure class is marked as such because of their consumption. But it's even deeper than this. If a member of the leisure class is to be recognized as such, their consumption must be conspicuous. Other people, especially those who are in the non-leisure class, have to see the consumption of the leisure class in order to socially embed the status of the leisure class. Consumption alone is not enough. It must be conspicuous in a way that confers real social status. Now, Veblen's ideas of conspicuous consumption are not reserved only for the leisure class. They can be applied across the board to just about anyone in any economic structure. Consider the calculations that go into the purchase of an automobile or a house by, say, a middle-class person. How should we describe the purchase of a $20,000 car by a person who makes working-class or middle-class wages? Some of this consumption can be described by noting the use value of the car. The person wants to get from point X to point Y in a safe and reliable way, and the car does this really well. But to be honest here, a $7,000 car could have probably done this just about as well. The use value we gain from our consumption won't explain a great deal of our consumption. This is where conspicuous consumption helps explain a good deal of consumer behavior at all levels of the economy. We often pay the extra money because of the signal it sends to others about our social status. The $20,000 or more expensive car signaled to others that we're doing just fine economically. We have money. The cheaper car sends the opposite signal. Of course, the exact opposite could be the case, and often people get into financial trouble trying to send social signals via conspicuous consumption. You can think about massive credit card debt here, for instance. But the motives for consumption involve their conspicuous nature. An engagement ring is a really good example of this, as is most consumption of jewelry. If others could not see your jewelry, how much would you value it? How much would you pay for it? Now, I realize that's a personal question, and answers will obviously differ here, but I suspect jewelry sales would fall by more than 95% if by some act of magic, jewelry became invisible and no longer conspicuous once a person left their house. And the case is even more stark when we consider something like an engagement ring. Of course, some people will just value what an engagement ring means to them, and perhaps never even leave the house with it. But that was never the purpose of an engagement ring. The ring is a symbolic signal in at least two economically interesting ways. First, the wearer of the ring is signaling to others that they are engaged or married and not likely to welcome advances. Second, the nature of the ring signals to others the economic status of the person's partner, and with it, their economic status. A 3-carat diamond engagement ring signals something different to the world than a quarter cut engagement ring. The size of the ring has nothing to do with the actual relationship, obviously, but as a signal of social status, the differences are real. Veblen's pioneering work has lasting impacts on the way that economists think about basic economic theory. Before Veblen, it was just taken as fact that as a good increases in price, the demand for them will drop. That makes a lot of sense. As things cost more, less people will buy them. But Veblen's work shows why this is not always the case. With certain luxury goods, and now they have the nickname Veblen goods, the demand actually goes up as the price goes up. A retailer might sell more Louis Vuitton handbags at the price of $2,000 rather than the price of $1,500. Now, according to basic economic theory, that isn't supposed to happen, but it often does happen with luxury goods. Why? Well, because people value the conspicuous nature of their consumption as a way to signal status, and if the good is cheaper, the desired effect is diminished. So imagine if Ferrari had a once-in-a-lifetime Black Friday sale, where they sold a brand new Ferrari for $50,000. And by the way, these $50,000 Ferraris would be exactly like the other high-quality models that typically run in the many hundreds of thousands of dollars. Now, I suspect they would sell a whole lot that day, but they would never be able to charge, say, even $250,000 for a car ever again, even if future cars were of much higher quality than they are now. This is because the conspicuous signaling of the Ferrari would lose its luster if anyone with an extra $50,000 can obtain it. Veblen shows us that the consumption that we often treat as a highly personal matter is frequently more immersed in our social world than we often realize or fully appreciate. He also shows that to genuinely understand economics and business generally, a person must be able to have a good sense of consumer psychology and social forces, and yes, even be able to put all these pieces together with philosophical thought. Until next time on Egg Timer Philosophy, wishing you good philosophical vibes.